Okay. What I want to do today is not so much give a lecture on results which I've gotten, but rather try to make some connections between what we heard yesterday and the day before by Stephen Altschul and some physical systems, namely the directed polymer in the random medium and the Carter-Parisi-Zhang equation, and basically go over some of the things of yesterday and Monday again in a more physics type of language. So to make it a little less formal, I'll try to do that on the board. That should also slow me down a little bit. So please, at any time, if you have questions, ask. And I mean, you can sort of steer me in different directions during the talk if you want. So what we already heard yesterday, that what we are interested in sequence alignment is we have sequences like that. And during most of the talk, I will actually use DNA sequences. Although the protein sequences are, of course, the more interesting part, the DNA sequences are sort of a little bit easier to understand because we don't have to deal with these with these 20 by 20 matrices, these Blossom matrices, and these PEM matrices usually. But most things that I will talk about are applicable to both of those problems. But for the examples, I will always use DNA sequences. Okay, let's assume we have these two sequences, and the purpose of sequence alignment, of course, is to find relationships between those two. For example, to find out that these two blocks and the two sequences are identical, which may be a hint that these are functionally related. And I mean, this is the one big application that Stephen told you about the last 2 days, all his examples basically. He used relationships between the sequences in order to infer functional relationships between the proteins or whatever this piece of DNA codes for. There is another important application actually of sequence alignment, and that's if you want to build phylogenetic trees, trees of species. Also, you can just go at sequences, you look at proteins, the same protein in different species, do sequence alignments of these proteins, and then try to infer an evolutionary distance from the sequence alignments and use that as the basis to build a tree. So that's basically the other big application of sequence alignments. It's by far not as big as the identification of function, but I mean, it's also something that sequence alignment is used a lot. Okay, as we already heard yesterday, you start a sequence alignment by assigning a local similarity score, SAB, for every pair of letters. And in this simple case where you have a DNA, what you usually do is you have a 1 for A equals B and some minus mu for A not equals B. And this mu is a parameter which you can tune. This is sort of what corresponds to these PAM and Blossom matrices we even talked about yesterday for DNA. For DNA, you don't really have a very good insight. I mean, basically, all letters and all that matters is if they are identical or different. You don't have this complicated relationship that some amino acids are more similar to others than others. So all you do is this. But I mean, when I use SAB later on, it may either mean this if I talk about DNA, or it may mean these Blossom and or PEM matrices, these 20 by 20 matrices, if we are talking about protein sequences. Okay, so the simplest case that Stephen talked about is the gapless alignment, and that's the case which is theoretically very well understood, so that's why I want to start with this as well. And in gapless alignment, you say, well, you assign a score, capital S, to each triplet of end positions in the first sequence, end positions in the second sequence, and length is L. So you look at all possible segments of equal length between the two sequences, and you allow these the end positions to shift, and this car which you assign to such an object is a sum k equals 0 minus 1 over s a I minus k b j minus k. So this is exactly, I mean, this is my I and this is my j. I just add up. You just add up these matches here. In this case, where I is whatever this is, j is whatever this is, and L is 6, this curve would be 6 because we have 6 times the 1. If we, for example, want to calculate 10, 12, and 7, that would mean we take this one as well, and this core would be 6 minus mu, because we have 6 matches and 1 mismatch. Okay, that you can do for every pair of positions and every triplet of positions and lengths, and the global comparison score is then just defined as the maximum over all I, j, and l of s, I, j, and l. Right? And that's what you say is a measure of the similarity of the two sequences. Okay. On first sight, it looks now as if in order to calculate this object, you would need n to the third time. Right? You have three variables, I, j, and l, and you want to calculate the maximum over those. So it looks as if you need n to the third time. But that's actually not the case if you define a quantity as j, as ij, as the maximum maximized only over this l, as ij and l, then there's a very convenient recursion equation, and that's what programs like BLAST use. Namely, well, what is as ij? There are two possibilities. Either this maximum is taken at length 0. At length 0, this core is obviously 0 since I'm not adding over anything. Or it's length 1 or more. Well, if it's length 1 or more, I definitely have to include the local comparison ij, because that's the last thing in whatever comes. And then I just take whatever has been optimal at the position I minus 1, j minus 1. Okay. Is that clear to everybody? Good. So this is now obviously a quadratic algorithm. You can calculate these capital Sij's in quadratic time by starting at the beginning of the sequence and then iterating it, and then at the end you take the maximum Sij. And that's exactly how the Swift-Waterman algorithm in the absence of gaps works. Okay. So the question, of course, and I think Stephen made that very clear yesterday, you have a nice algorithm, it gives you a number, you want to know what does it mean. Should you be surprised by the number you see, or shouldn't you? That's like the measure for significance of your comparison. And so what one wants to know is how the statistics of this thing behaves. Before we go to the statistics of this thing, I first want to mention this question of the phase transition, which we talked about yesterday, because that is very easy to see what's happening here. If we are interested in only random sequences, first of all, and I mean we now want to only study random sequences because that's the background for the natural sequences, then obviously it doesn't really matter where you slide your window in a random sequence, right? Random sequences are translationally invariant. So what I will be doing is I will be looking only at S of t, and I call that, that's just an abbreviation for STT, so I just take the same letters of the two sequences, and this then fulfills the recursion equation 0 and small s of t f capital s of t f minus 1. I now only go along the diagonal. This here is a random variable. Which is just given by whatever scores can appear and what the probabilities for the letters are which make up these scores. And so what we have here is essentially something like a random walk, right? We always add a random variable up to our intermediate score. Just in addition to just adding random variables, whenever this thing goes below zero, we set it back to zero. So that's what this algorithm is all about. And now it's easy to see what the phase transition is. The phase transition is exactly this condition, given by this condition, if the expectation value of this random variable here is positive or negative. You remember that Stephen yesterday, for his theory, he said, well, this expectation value has to be negative. But what happens if this is positive? If this is positive, if you plot s as a function of t, then what happens is that typically this thing will go up, so it doesn't even matter at all that you cut the zero off. It is just a pure random walk, and as such, of course, if you then look at some certain length n, the maximum score along this would be somewhere very close to the end, and therefore it would be proportional to the length of the sequence. I mean, to n squared, of course, if you take two sequences, because you have to do that for every diagonal, which, I mean, in principle, is just n squared long. Okay, so that's why one calls this the linear phase of sequence alignment. On the other hand, if s is less than zero, then something very different happens. And the way this looks like, as a function of t, is, well, typically it will always try to go down, so it will stay at zero because it can't go down. Every now and then, you will have a good score, but since the average score is negative, it will always return to zero and hit the zero line again, and it will do that over and over again. So what we get is a configuration of independent objects. These humps here are independent islands. Now the question is, well, what's the maximum score here? Well, the maximum score is, of course, the highest score in the largest island. And what we are finally would be interested in is to calculate what the distribution of this maximum score in the largest island is. Well, here you can already see where this extreme value distribution comes in. Because, well, these islands are all independent objects, you can assign to every island an island peak score . And of course, if you have long sequences, you have lots of them. So your total similarity score is just given as the maximum over all these island peak scores. These island peak scores are independent random variables. And because of that, you always, if you take the maximum of many independent random variables, if those are not too badly behaved, you will end up with an extreme value distribution. And that's where the extreme value distribution comes in. Okay. Of course, if you look at this theory of Carlin and Dembo, which actually proves that this is an extreme value distribution and which gives you the values. So, okay, let me just draw the extreme value distribution once more. It looks roughly like that. That's the distribution of the score, and it is given by that the probability of this core being less than x is e to the minus kappa e to the minus lambda x. Let me just see if it is correct. So if this x becomes very large, this is 0, so we have 1. Yeah, that's the right way around. Okay, so this Kalman-Alscher theory tells you that this is indeed the case, and it also tells you what this kappa and lambda is. So the kappa is what Stephen called Kmn yesterday. Okay. Of course, the hard part, and I think that Amir will tell you something about that tomorrow, is you have this alignment grid here, and you actually go down all these diagonals here and take the maximum over everything. So these random variables S of t, which are just the comparisons course everywhere, they're not really independent random variables, right? They are calculated. They are n squared of those, but there are only two n letters, which you show. So they can't be independent. So there are correlations in here, actually. And the really hard part of the proof that this is still a 16 value distribution is to show that these sort of correlations don't really matter. But I mean, we won't deal with that problem. What? Okay. Well, this is a result which is only asymptotically true for long sequences. And I mean, yes. Right. But okay. If x is zero, then you would get a finite probability for that, which of course. Wait. Okay, I mean that is part of. I mean, you're sort of asking what's happening very far down here. I mean, kappa is k, this constant which is 1/10 times the product of the length of the sequences. So that is typically an extremely large number, and this result is only true in the limit that these are large. So, I mean, it is finite, although it should not be finite because, of course, you cannot have any score less than zero. But, I mean, what this result says is just in the limit of large m and n, this describes the distribution out here. And it, indeed, does not exactly describe this part of the distribution, but it does describe the large score part of it. Right. Oh, when it is logarithmic in this, as far when if the expectation value of s is less than zero, because I mean if you can just calculate the expected value from this, and it okay, now I'm mixing up capital N's, and I should stick with my capital N's and M. Yeah. If you calculate, well, if you equate m and n here. If you assume you have a square system, then this will be logarithmic. I mean, basically, because you have independent tries, and the score you get just grows logarithmic in the number of tries. So what actually happens if it's exactly zero? I mean, I never thought about it. I mean, definitely you should. You still have a finite probability to run away to infinity, right? So, it's certainly not Gamble, but I mean, the question: what would be exactly the power law or the function of n which you would find? Some power law below 1. But I mean, at the end, of course, the interesting regime you want to be in is of course this one here. I mean, because exactly for this reason that you want to find only short pieces of sequences. So if you're in this regime, if you locally have something which matches well, so on a piece of scores, you have a positive expectation value. If you do that here, what happens is you go up and then you maybe go up a little bit steeper if that is where you have the matches, and then you go parallel again. So you don't really gain a whole lot in that score. So it's very hard to see something like that, a local match, in that sort of scoring system. Here, you still have the same humps, and then suddenly you have one hump, which becomes very big because you have all these good matches here. And so in this regime here, it's much easier to pick up from this final score that there was a local piece which matched very well. That's the reason why you always, to do these comparisons, you always want to be in this regime. And you always want to be sort of well in this regime. And it's not really good if you're even very close to zero. If the typical length of these islands here becomes of the order of your sequence length, then you effectively already end up in this regime. So you want to stay away from that at least that much, that the typical length of these islands is much shorter than your sequence length, which you compare. Is that okay? Okay, so now, I mean, we know where the Gumbel distribution comes from, but we would like to know where this lambda and this k come from. Well, the k, as we already heard yesterday, is a very different story. That's very hard to get, and I mean, even the formula looks very nasty. So let's stick to the lambda. The lambda is, of course, also the more important one because it appears here in the exponent. So if you're off with lambda, I mean, you make really a big mistake, whereas if you're off with k, your p-values are not that much off. Well, we know that this is a maximum of these island peak scores. So if we know the distribution of island peak scores, obviously we can calculate how these parameters kappa and lambda depend on the distribution of the island peak scores. I mean, it's a simple operation. We take the maximum of many of those, and you can actually just work that out, and I probably will do that after showing you what the island peak score distribution is. But so what we want to do is we can forget now about this maximization and ask ourselves, well, what's the distribution of individual island peak scores in order to get a handle on what this lambda is? And that is much simpler because island peak scores, islands by definition, have positive scores. So we can forget about this zero in the algorithm here inside an island. And therefore, we are basically just left with a random walk, right? And everybody knows what to do with a random walk. But the random walk is a little bit tricky here because...
Ooh. That's a dangerous thing here.
I mean, if this were a continuous time random walk up here, and that would of course mean that these random variables would have to be Gaussian random variables with some diffusion constant and some drift. We have a random walk with drift here. Then of course you would know how to calculate the distribution of the maximum of such a random walk, and what you would find is just that the distribution of these maximums of random walk would go like e to the minus lambda sigma, so that would be exponential distribution, and lambda would just be v over d, hopefully. If v is your drift and d is your diffusion. Here it's a little bit trickier. We have discrete time, and these random variables up there have some sort of weird discrete distribution. Right? So what can we do in that case? Well, that's also what Stephen talked about yesterday already. I mean, he didn't show it, so I will show you how one can find that. That's, again, a heuristic argument. If you want to do that rigorously, that becomes much worse. What you do is, well, you change actually the question. That will be very important, because instead of just asking what is the distribution of the island peak scores, you ask, well, how does a typical island look like? You're not interested only in the peak score, you're actually also interested in how often does which pair of amino acids appear in the island. And if you ask that question, then you will get this distribution sort of as a corollary out of that. And that will be something which I think will reappear throughout this program over and over again. This question, you start with some random backgrounds things, you select on it by, for example, here asking for a high scoring island, and you end up with some different composition of this new object. Right, and that is what we like to call the extremal ensemble. So let's look how this works. Okay. So what we want to know is the... Okay, we have two parameters here. I call them pi, the probabilities. For pair I. Okay, to save some writing here, before we had these pi, pj, which is the real probability, let's call them, we had. If these are the probabilities for the individual amino acids, then now I just write an I for actually this pair ij. And after doing this up there, it doesn't really matter that this random variable is generated by first picking a pair of random letters and then calculating a score. I can just ask, well, how many different scores appear, all of them by I, and then assign a probability to all of those. Right? So and I call these things now the PIs, and then the SIs are the scores, score for pair I. Okay. Now, how do we characterize an island? Well, we say, yeah, in an island, there are ni letters, or letter pairs, of type I. Okay? So I just count how often I see which letter pair. That, of course, describes, I mean, it doesn't tell me which order they are, but the order doesn't really matter in the island. Sure. Oh, okay. Okay, I'm only talking about the part from the beginning to the top. I really forget. That is, I mean, what also corresponds to the match, which you would see. I mean, after that, nothing happens. It just goes down with whatever the average S would be. So what I'm concerned with now is just the piece from the beginning to the peak. Yeah, sorry, I didn't mention that. So what we can say is the probability for such a configuration is, of course, just the multinomial coefficient, because I didn't say what the, I mean, I forgot about the order of these guys, times the probability to get one to the power ni. That's the probability to get those guys. And this core of this island is just the sum over mi sigma I. Now what we want to do is fix sigma of ni, the sum sigma 0, and maximize the probability. So we are asking, if we want to have a certain island peak score, what is the sort of configuration which are the most probable one to reach the score? Okay. I don't know if I should go through all the steps here now. Probably not. All you do is you use Lagrange multipliers. So what you do is you calculate d log p by d and I, and you have some Lagrange multiplier lambda here, ds by d and I, by sigma. And if you calculate that, what you get is log of the sum ni pi divided by ni plus lambda si. No, not necessarily. If I do it with a 1 and minus mu, and I have, for example, DNA, which has 1/4 match probability and 3/4 mismatch probability, then the variables here would be S1 equals 1 with probability P1 1/4, and S2 equals minus mu with P2 equals 3/4 for DNA. For proteins, we would have whatever. If you look at the blossom matrix, there are maybe 20 different numbers in there, and all of those appear with give a certain score and have a certain probability according to what sort of background frequencies we have chosen. So they do not have to be positive. As a matter of fact, we are still in the regime that the expected value in general, according to these PI, the background frequencies, has to be negative, because we want to talk about islands. Otherwise, this whole thing doesn't make sense. Of course, since it goes up here, what we find at the end is the expected value within an island is positive. Okay, so at this point, we do not know yet what lambda is, right? Lambda was just the Lagrange multiplier. But if we solve this for the ni, we get this equation, which we have already seen 2 days ago, namely the proportion of the pairs I in an island is what would be its background frequency skewed with this e to the lambda si factor. Of course, obviously, these objects here have to add up to 1. And this is exactly the equation for this parameter lambda. I wouldn't have called it lambda if that wouldn't be the lambda which we want to have at the end. So this is exactly the condition for this parameter lambda, which Stephen told us about yesterday. And this will be the parameter lambda which appears in the extreme value distribution at the very end. But we really learned 2 things from this exercise. Well, okay, I haven't shown you yet that this lambda actually has something to do with the island peak score distribution. But what we definitely have learned, that we have to pick this lambda, and that then the amino acid frequencies, or the pair frequencies, within an island are given by this relation, where the bare frequencies are multiplied with this e to the lambda si. And of course, the lambda is exactly the unique lambda at which this is again a probability distribution, because things, I mean, if you would pick the wrong lambda here, these things would not add up to one. Sigma naught indeed disappears in this. Yes, the condition on lambda doesn't have anything to do with sigma naught. How the sigma naught gets back into so this relationship between bare frequencies and frequencies within an island under this selection criterion to be in a large high-scoring island is really completely independent of what sigma zero is. And that's, I mean, that's why you even can get such a concept, because it really doesn't matter how large the island is, as long as it's large. I mean, there was some Stirling formula and so on in between. It has to be a large island, otherwise that's not true. But as long as it's large, it doesn't matter how large it is for this relation to hold. And sigma zero cancels out. Of course, then we can calculate what is the probability that we have a sigma zero. And I mean, here we have the probability for a certain configuration, and we just calculated what sort of the largest contribution to this term is. So if we just take this formula here and substitute these and i's in here, then if you go through the whole calculation, you indeed, okay, for log, you get minus lambda times sigma zero. That's where the sigma zero comes back. Okay, basically, okay, maybe not so obvious how where this comes from. You know that the sigma zero must be still the sum over the NISI. And this is N. Okay, now I have to look at how this works. Where this is just the sum over NI. Okay, these N's I have to put in there, from up there, e to the lambda SI. And this is what you would just call N over lambda. Sum over something is wrong here. So somehow you have to get back to the relative entropy here, which I'm just losing. Okay, that is the log. What did I do wrong here now? The lambda SI is log of QI over PI. So we would like to have a QI in front. Right, did that? Oh, and there it is, yeah, okay. E to the lambda SI. So this is N over lambda times the relative entropy between the scoring system, between these two distributions, which we have here, the bare frequencies and the frequencies in the extremely long number. So the The most important message about that is the score of an island is proportional to the length of an island. There's a linear relation between score and length. Right? And the proportionality factor is just its relative entropy. And then, I mean, it's not so surprising that this logarithm, which is of course also an extensive quantity in the length, so that should be proportional to the length, and then you can change the length via this relation into the score of the island, and then if you get all the prefactors right, you exactly get this justice lambda. Okay, so what we get is that P of sigma 0 is some constant times e to the minus lambda sigma 0. That is only for large sigma 0, and that's also why this constant here, we don't know what it is. It's not given by a normalization condition because this is only asymptotically true. So this constant could be anything. And I mean, this constant is actually part of what this k is at the end, and that's part of why this k is so high. Right. I mean, what you're basically doing is a saddle point approximation. It doesn't. I mean, yeah, we have been thinking about that. I mean, Ikram and I for a long time. It's not everything. It's saddle point. Okay. It's partially. I mean, that may be true if you only look for the maximum of the random walk. But I mean, if you're really interested in the island peak score, you have to take into account these effects. Like, this is not really a random walk because it's not allowed to go down before it finally goes up. Right? This changes your prefactor. The same thing in this sum here, walks which come up, go a little bit down at the end, and still end up at sigma are also in there. You have to forbid those if you want to really know the island peak score. And all these things all change the prefactor. That's why you cannot just get it from the other point. Okay? Right. I mean, this is basically just a subtle point of approximation approach. You look for the configurations which give you the maximum probability for getting the score. Right. What's the best path to get there? Yeah. Right. Right. And then, I mean, I just say, okay. I mean, since I can't get the prefactor anyways, and then just say, well, the saddle point gives me the exponential behavior, and I forget about the prefactor. Yeah, that is true as long as lambda is very small. I mean, if you take this equation e to the lambda s expectation value equals 1, I mean, that's what this equation means, right? And then you start expanding that, the exponential. I mean, but if lambda is small, then you get s squared. One, and then this this is minus v, and okay, the s squared becomes the diffusion constant, and then And that is exactly what you want to get. Right? But I mean, so this is really the generalization of this result. But I mean, the important point is, from this calculation, you do not only get this distribution of INP scores, but you also get this relation here, which tells you if you start with background frequencies, you select according to highest scoring island, what sort of pair frequencies do we typically have? And that is what allows, in the case of gap disalignment, which allows people to choose a scoring system such that it's most significant for certain target frequencies. I mean, if you know these things which you're looking for, these you anyways know, then you can of course calculate the scores, the SI, which best kind of. Right. Yeah. I mean, in terms of these end effects, it's definitely approximate. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. But I mean, this is really it is rigorously proven. I just wanted to give you a flavor of where things come from in an approximate way, because I mean, to understand the proof is, I mean, very tedious. Right. Exactly. Right. Not k. Yeah. I mean, for k, you really have to work hard. I mean, the exponential thing is easy to get inside of one approximation. The feedback is it's hard. I mean, Adembo tomorrow, I mean, he is one of the people who have done this exactly. I mean, there are, of course, different versions with, I mean, little different things they say, but I mean, he's one of the people who worked out this proof, but I mean, I'm sure he will not present this proof either tomorrow. Is that for an arbitrary? Okay, I mean, I know that, I mean, it goes like to the 70s in the math literature, to like Eberhard and people like that. I mean, I sort of followed the Okay. Now, of course, if we know this, then you can just take a maximum of many of those. That's pretty easy. So, I guess it already vanished. Now you can do it since it's so nice. So what you want to know is the probability that your total maximum score is less than some score x. And this is obviously the probability that your island peak score is less than x to the power rho mn, where mn is the size of your two sequences, and rho is sort of the typical density of these islands. We don't know that. That's also, if you want to know k, you have to know what the typical density of these islands is. But this is the number of islands we typically have, and so the probability that the maximum is less than x is just the power that these individual islands are all less than x. That we can now rewrite as 1 minus the opposite, and the opposite is given by this exponential, and if the distribution that the score is sigma 0 is exponential, then the integral over that is exponential as well. So let's say we have z prime here, e to the minus under X in this case, so the row MN, and then this is just for large X when this thing in here is a small parameter. This just gives you C prime row MN e to the minus 1 to X. So this thing you would identify at this K. And well, this lambda is now really the lambda given by this condition is the lambda which appears in the end of the Gumbel distribution. Okay. I mean, here you see why calculating K is really hard, because you have to know how long a typical island is, and you have to know this prefect of the distribution which contains all these weird effects. If you have to start with something positive, you have to end with something positive, and so on. Okay, so far for the gapless alignment. Now, unfortunately, gapless alignment, as Stephen already said, it's very nice because you understand the theory completely, but it's not very useful because people know that during evolution you can get insertion events, you can get deletion events, and if your alignment algorithm doesn't know about that, it will not be able to pick up similarities which are very weak, because the individual pieces might still line up, but they are not significant matches, and only if you see, aha, these two are close together, and with a little gap I could connect them, then they can become significant. So that's why you want to allow gaps in your alignments. So what do you do with gaps? For example, okay, my original sequences are of course long gone, but you remember that there was a piece of six letters in there which was identical, and if I write down the same sequences with gaps, now you can see, you have to believe me that it's the same sequences. Input, if I insert these gaps, then you see I get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 matches, and just one mismatch in here. So that may be a sign, that even more of a sign that these two are related than just finding this piece of six sequences in there. What? Stephen already told you how you deal with this problem of alignment, and this is now global alignment with gaps, since I aligned both sequences in their whole length. What you do is, again, for DNA, you look at all possible alignments of this type. Now, that's not a choice of like final positions and length, but now it's a choice of where I could possibly insert these gaps. And there's obviously an exponential number of these alignments around. But with every alignment, which I just call this telegraphic A, you say, well, this core of that alignment should be 1 times the number of matches minus mu times the number of mismatches. Well, that's not very interesting yet. But you also have to introduce now a new parameter, delta, which is the number of gaps in this alignment. Because otherwise you can just put in as many gaps as you want and you will always end up with matches only, but that doesn't have any significance whatsoever. Of course, in practice, for proteins, you again here replace that by this blossom matrix for everything which is aligned to each other. And here, you typically use these things where you also look at the length of a gap. So this just counts this as two gaps. It doesn't matter. I mean, this is 1, 1, 2, and so on and so forth. For real useful alignments, you usually count the first gap with a very high cost, and then if you extend that with a very low cost in order to mimic that it's, it's hard to insert something, but once you're at inserting something, it can be a bigger piece. Again, in order to make things simpler, I just show it that way. Okay. The total score we want to look at is again the maximum of all those alignments maximized over the alignment. And that is now not only n to the third, these are now exponentially many, but as Stephen already pointed out, there is this dynamic programming algorithm, as the computer scientists like to call that, our transfer matrix algorithm, as we would probably call that, with which you can do that. You just write the two sequences at the edges of a square. So on and so forth, and you put this sort of a lattice on here. And then you draw in this lattice, the horizontal lines correspond to matches and mismatches, and the diagonal lines are the gaps. So for example, this alignment would then have a gap for this G. It's not aligned to anything, so I mark this bond. This C is not aligned to anything, I mark this bond. Then these two T's are aligned to each other, these two A's are aligned to each other, and then there's another gap, so I would go back, and it would probably, there are other gaps back there. So at the end, every alignment corresponds to one path to this lattice here. And once you realize that, of course, you can use this recursive scheme that you say, okay, I call Hij the score of the best path ending in the point Hij. So I now again count these things as Ij. And the score of the best path ending in point Ij is the maximum of the three ways I could have gotten there. So it's A H I minus 1 J minus 1 plus S A I J H I J minus 1 minus delta H I minus 1 J minus delta. So I could have either come from behind, in that case my new score is what I had, plus whatever the comparison locally is at that point, given by Blossom of 1 and minus mu, or if I come diagonally, I have to pay the gap cost for this point. Well, that's where basically Terry and Michael, who are both here, discovered, well, that looks very well known to us, that is basically just energy of a directed polymer in a random medium. How would you look at the directed polymer? Directed polymer is basically just a one-dimensional object which you describe by a function R of t. It does not allow to have any overhangs typically. And so the possible configurations of that are the different shapes, and you have this order around. Famous examples is, for example, in a type 2 superconductor, when you have like a vortex line, and there's that would be a two-dimensional example, where space is two-dimensional, where you have pinning centers, and this polymer. On the one hand, it's expensive for the polymer to extend its length to make a lot of humps. On the other hand, it tries to find low energy pinning centers in order to optimize its overall energy. And the way one usually describes that in this any coordinates here, you usually describe that in a continuous way as the path integral, so that's the partition function of an object, and you integrate to whatever time you're looking at, and then you have to have temperature here. It depends on how you have this term, which is just the Wiener measure. I mean, that's just what tells you that it's expensive to make this thing longer. Plus, another important part, this. This random contribution, this is just a random function, which usually is chosen Gaussian, uncorrelated in time and space. And it basically, that just means it picks up all the energy it gets on the way, right? And that is the same situation as up here. What we have up here is something which has, I mean, the different states, the different alignments are the different configurations of this thing. In every configuration, the energy which comes with that is just the sum over the energy along the bonds. If I these energies are random because they have been chosen according to these matches and mismatches. Of course, they are not uncorrelated and they are not Gaussian, but I mean, we believe in universality, so that should not really matter. And of course, this term here just comes from the fact that we have this sort of lattice, right? And we can at most go one step up or down. As a matter of fact, if you want to simulate something like that, what you usually do is you pick a lattice. Typically, most times you would just pick a square lattice and say, well, this is time, this is space, and then you allow transitions at every point only into three neighboring positions. And then you can calculate the partition function of this thing by a dynamic programming or transfer matrix algorithm by saying, okay, if I want to know the partition function here, I could have gotten here from these three places, so just sum of the contributions, take the sum of the contributions coming from here. Or if you take this temperature to zero, then you actually end up with this maximum here. You have the best contribution. That's something where Eco will be talking about quite a bit, I guess, on Friday, and I think Mike Lessig will talk about that this afternoon as well. You can now play this game the other way around. Okay, you see, this is the zero temperature version of this. You can say, well, maybe we can do something to sequence alignment if we actually use the finite temperature version of that. And this should also, if nothing really bad happens here, we are in one dimension, so temperature is irrelevant. So you should be able to just crank up the temperature a little bit, and you get a different alignment algorithm, which may have slightly different properties, but which may nevertheless be useful. And I think that Michael and Iko will tell you that it actually does have much nicer properties than the zero temperature alignment. But I'll stick to the zero temperature. Right. Well, I mean, numerically, that is some work of Michael Terry and Dirk Drasto. I mean, they looked at most of these scaling laws, which you would expect for KPZ, and they all seem to be okay. There's one quantity, I don't really remember which one it was, which is sort of weird, but... Yeah, but I mean, basically, I mean, all these scaling exponents which you would expect are still there. Yeah. You mean how one takes the correlation into account in the... Well, I mean, the correlation is not that bad, because, I mean, the correlations are along these diagonals. So, I mean, in a sense, you still cannot go through any letter more than once. I mean, that's at least how I think about it, yeah, right? So the correlation, and if you have passed... If you have passed this letter, then you will never really experience what's going on down here. So, I mean, the most you can walk is along these diagonals, and the correlations also run along these same diagonals. This is very hand-wavy. I mean, what you really have to do is to look at the numerics and see that everything still works out. I don't know of any work which takes these correlations into account. I mean, obviously, I mean, I don't know of any physics work which knows about these correlations, and also people in bioinformatics, mathematicians who look at this problem. Usually, I mean, the first thing is, let's assume that these guys are uncorrelated, and then we start from there. And it does make a difference. I mean, in terms of numbers, it does make a difference. In terms of universal quantities, it does not. But even in terms of numbers, the difference becomes smaller, and I think I show some examples, the larger the alphabet sizes. And with proteins, already in a pretty safe area where, I mean, even the numbers are not too far off. I mean, this may become a little clearer. Okay, there's a different way still to think about that, and that is it's known for a long time that directed polymers in the random medium are also equivalent to the KPZ equation, which describes surface growth. And that can also immediately be seen, of course, and I think for that I'd rather show you the picture than just talk a lot. So what you see here is actual sequence alignment, and what's plotted is, and that's actually data of Harry, Michael, and Gusto. Instead of going on the square letters, you just keep the same sort of letters, but you make it rectangular, right? You just make a long strip, you start with some initial configuration, and then you let this thing evolve according to this recursion equation here. And what you see if you do that for different times is, so what's plotted here is the score at a given time slice, the score as a function of this coordinate. And so you can see that, well, you start with something very smooth, and you have very small roughness on that, and you have two things happening. One is the average score is moving around, and the other thing is that the fluctuations here start growing, and that, of course, they do with the typical KPZ exponent. And this is exactly the surface picture of KPZ. So you should think about that as being the coordinate of a surface of a crystal, a one-dimensional crystal, which it starts here, and then you start depositing stuff, and it is going this way down. And so the analogies here, we put them together again, is that if you, what in global alignment is this core, is for the directed polymer actually the free energy, and in the surface picture it is the height of the surface at this point. In global alignment, the average sequence position, with that I mean the mean between the I and the J coordinate, is the longitudinal position of this polymer along this axis, and its time in k to z, and the relative sequence position, which is how much one sequence is ahead of the other, is the perpendicular position here, and that's the space coordinate in k to z. So that's just for the sort of translations between these problems. It will turn out that, at least in a very simple case, it's not only k to z, but it's even an exactly solvable model in k to z. But from the picture, you can immediately tell that they should be in the same universality class after this problem with the correlations, which doesn't turn out to be a big problem. Okay. Now let's look at this picture here once again. Of course, this, and Stephen talked about that. Okay, we have to do one step more. This is global sequence alignment. Global sequence alignment with gaps. Again, people really want to do local sequence alignment with gaps. What they do for that is the same game. Well, let me write it down again. I like to use H for global alignment because they correspond to these surface heights, and capital S's for local alignments. So for local alignments with gaps, you actually use this recursion equation, which is the same one as that. But you put in this extra zero here. The same thing as we did in gapless alignment. It was basically a random walk, which was reset to zero whenever it would go below zero. Here, it is basically KPZ surface world, but whenever we hit the bottom, we reset it. And of course, the reasoning behind that is, again, you want to be able to start a local alignment at every point. So that's why you put the zero in there. If you go negative, you say, okay, that it doesn't look very promising here. I want to start someplace else. And then at the end, of course, you maximize over ij in order to pick the best point. Okay, so this thing, of course, works also not for all parameters, but it again has a phase transition, and it's the same log linear phase transition as we had in the gapless case. In the gapless case, you probably remember that this was the condition to be in the logarithmic phase. Here it's not that easy anymore. This is certainly a necessary condition here. If that's not fulfilled, then even without gaps, we can already go up. But even if that is negative, if we can put in gaps and pick up some extra matches that way, we are now allowed to optimize over different ways to put in gaps, we can still, on average, gain score and get into a global alignment phase that way, into a linear phase. And the condition, of course, for the phase transition here is that the average value of H has to be less than zero for time infinity. Right? That basically takes into account the fact that the gaps sort of give you an extra growth on the surface. That, okay, I say that is obvious. I mean, for the alignment people, there is again, a pretty complicated paper, which actually proves it mathematically rigorously, that that is the condition which you should look at in order to find the phase transition line, to first say, I mean, which parameter regime it even makes sense to do these local alignments. So now, to show you an example of such a phase transition line, I mean, in general, for gapped alignment, you just have to try it. I mean, you can numerically, of course, calculate this expectation value of H for arbitrary parameter setting, and then you see if it's positive or negative, and you can find the phase transition line that way. And that's what people do in order to find it. In a specific case, you can actually get a pretty good idea where it is. And I want to show that to you as an example. But if you know that this thing is it's KPZ, then you know that in KPZ, these objects, rod H of RT, if I fix T and look at different Rs, these become independent random variables, basically. So that just means that sort of these things here, you know, except for the periodic boundary conditions here, of course, are basically just random walks, because the steps you take become independent random variables. So you can say, okay, what corresponds to the gradient here? But that would be something of the form hij hij plus 1. So you look at differences like across here. And then, okay, of course you don't do that for every ij. So what you look at basically is this difference, and this difference, and this, and this. This corresponds to sort of equal time differences. In the discrete system, of course, they do not have to be uncorrelated. But what you can do is you can just assume that these guys are uncorrelated, and then self-consistently calculate what is the distribution of these delta H. I mean, these delta H can have certain possible values. It actually turns out that they can have only finitely many values. And you can ask, well, what's the distribution of that? And you get a self-consistent equation for this distribution. And this actually works only in the case where we have this 1 minus mu, and then the gap cost delta. But still, in this case, you can basically, and if you know this distribution, you can calculate what the expectation value of H is, on the other hand, and then you know where the phase transition is. So you have an approximation because you assumed something here which is not necessarily true. But this allows you to actually draw a line in this parameter space mu and delta. And I have this line here for an alphabet of four letters. That's what this C equals 4 means. And if you actually do this program here, what you get is this red line here. And if you do simulations, you get these squares. And as you see, I mean, it's not exact, but I mean, it's a pretty good approximation. Also here, you get an idea. These squares, which are so close to each other, these two are one is for correlated disorder and one is for uncorrelated disorder. Of course, in all these calculations, you would also don't deal with these correlations. So you see, there is a difference in numbers, but these differences are pretty small. One thing to note also, because we'll use that later on, you have this special line mu equals 2 delta here. And why is that special? If you look at a piece of the lattice like that, with a mismatch, you have minus mu, minus delta, minus delta. So whenever the gap cost is smaller than this condition, then it is cheaper, instead of doing a mismatch, to just go around the mismatch in your alignment. So actually, if you make the gap cost smaller than that, everything becomes independent of the parameter mu. And that's why this line is completely horizontal on the other side. So that's sort of a very special case here. And if you know this, I mean, if you know what happens on this line, then you know everything on here. Okay. So now we know how the global and the local, the local one has already gone, alignment with gap works. So now again the question is, of course, what is the statistics of that? Well, the statistics, we know that it's a Gumbel distribution that Stephen already told us from experiments, and why, from numerical experiments, and why this is the case. Sure. Right, otherwise you lose your Gumbel distribution. I mean, what practically is chosen is, okay, so the boundary is the place where this value lambda in your Gumbel distribution vanishes, right? I mean, your islands become larger and larger, and the distribution becomes broader and broader, and eventually it vanishes and you don't have islands anymore. So what the NCBI recommends is to use lambdas which are at 80% of the gapless value. That is sort of quite a bit away from the phase solution. Right? That, I mean, basically what you want to have is still the same criterion. Your islands should not become of the size of your sequences. And then if you take typical sequences of the length, whatever, 200, 300 amino acids for proteins, and you look at what typical relative entropies are, relative entropy just being the average scope of length, then you come up with a lambda which is on the order of 80%. Right. Well, I mean, certainly numbers will change. I don't know. I never tried to get this result. I mean, the whole picture, of course, does not change. I mean, it's just a sort of local change in your rules, so you wouldn't expect anything universal to change. But I mean, yeah, you would then have, of course, a two-dimensional phase transition surface and a three-dimensional parameter space, and I don't know how this looks like. Right. Yeah, you can think about that as being sort of a bending rigidity. But then on the other hand, you have bending rigidity, but you also have this Wiener measure. So in the end, I mean, it doesn't really matter that you have bending rigidity if you just go to large enough scales. But I mean, it does change, of course, all the numbers. I mean, in principle, you, of course, would like to know what the phase transition line is for a Blossom 62 matrix with affine gap costs, where you then had like 190 something dimensional parameter space. I mean, if you leave the matrix open, you just have a 20 by 20 matrix on the lower diagonal, and then you want to know what's the phase position of that one. So I don't know where, but it is. No. Basically, I mean, you want to be beyond the phase transition line in order to be in this logarithmic phase, to have low background, basically, right? The further you go away from the phase transition line, the lower your background becomes. If you go too far into the regime, you have the logarithmic score, then even your signal will not go into a large island anymore. So, I mean, there is a sort of a trade-off. I mean, if you want to detect something which is 90% identical, it doesn't really matter where you go. But if you're interested in detecting very weak signals, then you can't go too far into the logarithmic regime either, because then your signal doesn't come up anymore either. Right. Right. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there are people who do alignment really want to be in that regime where, I mean, I would tend to say if that happens, that probably happens by mistake, although it happens that people choose this coin system which has these sort of things. But I mean, I think Michael will probably talk about that this afternoon. So. Okay, so why do we still get a Gumball distribution here? What you can do is you can look at this alignment lattice, and for every point, the recursion equation is up there. For every point, it can either be zero, or if it's non-zero, it usually has come from something which was non-zero as well. You have these two possibilities, so you draw a green line whenever you for the bond which you chose in this recursion. And if you do that all over the lattice, you see again these objects, they start somewhere where just by chance this guy was zero, but this was a match, so you had a positive score. These are these blue circles here. But every other point of the lattice which has a positive score can be assigned to one of these blue circles by just going back along the path until you hit the point where it started. So by doing this assignment, you again can subdivide the whole lattice into these individual events. These we call, again, the islands. And they are, of course, more complicated now. They are not just random walks. They are something different. But these things, again, somewhere, and this is what the red dots are meant to be, have their highest score. So if you know what the distribution of highest score of these islands are, then you, again, just take the maximum of many independent of those, and you end up with your extreme value distribution. That, of course, completely, again, ignores the fact that these are correlated. They are correlated first because the disorder is correlated. Even if the disorder were not correlated, they are sort of correlated because they can run into each other, and you have to decide which island something belongs to. I mean, that is sort of, since for gapless alignment, these things don't really matter, one would not really expect this for gapped alignment to matter as well. The different story is within an island, these correlations coming from these letters. This is really something which can matter, but most probably the correlations between these islands do not matter. But I mean, that again, we still have the same mechanism, right? We have these islands around, and we take the maximum of many of those. And if we know the island peak score distribution, we know what the final distribution is. Here I really drew every positive point. I mean, that's like in the one-dimensional case. I mean, I'm really interested only in that, but if I want to draw all positive scores, I would have a tail of positive scores. The thing which is then really the biologic, what you would report if you were to do a database search, would be only the piece from here to here, from here to here, from here to here, and so on and so forth. That would be what the actual alignment would be. But I mean, here I just showed every point with a positive score. Well, of course, you can, on your computer, also look at that and do an actual alignment, take two sequences, and then this is, I mean, the I and J go these two ways, and then the blue points is where the score is zero, and then it becomes the redder, the higher the score, and you can really and just visually see how this thing decomposes into all these islands. Okay.
So that's why
Yeah, right. This is actually protein simulation. This is a protein simulation. I'm not sure if it was plasm 52 or PAM 250, but this is real. A fine gap cross, it's a real, definitely a real protein sequence. I mean, randomly chosen protein sequence and a real comparison matrix. Oh, no, it's a generated sequence. A randomly generated sequence using one of the usual substitution matrices. Okay. So how are you doing in time? So the question is now, what is the condition for the IMP scores? And I don't know if Ico will do that on Friday, but you can sort of argue in a similar way, at least if you do this finite temperature problem. You can again ask, well, how does a typical island look like? And for a finite temperature problem, you can actually tell, well, that's how it looks like, and that's what the distribution of the island peaks was. You can do sort of a hand-waving derivation of what the p-score distribution should be as one. I don't think I will actually do it, but I just try to motivate how you can get at this lambda. The point is, for the gapless alignment, you remember that this is the condition for the quantity lambda, and all that means basically is if you have a single nucleotide, you can have these two distributions. One is the one which is the bare distribution, one is the one which is typical for islands. And this just normalizes between those two and tells you, well, if you take the background distribution and weight everything such that high scoring things are more probable and low scoring things are less probable, then this is the unique way to do it such that you get a distribution again. So what happens for gapped alignments is, for gapped alignments you can't look at every position by itself anymore. Right? What you're doing is, if it's still true in an alignment you have only positive scores, so you can say, okay, inside an island you have only positive scores, so you look only at global alignment, not at local alignment, right? Inside an island. I forgot about the fact that I have islands, I just want to know what's the island peak score distribution, and then I know how to get to the Gamba distribution. So inside an island I have global alignment, but I mean global alignment is still this terrible object where it can have an L by L matrix, and if I choose two random sequences here for every pair of random sequences, I can calculate some global alignment score H of L here at the end. But this thing does not really, it's not just a sum of things, it's very complicated combination of all those things. What, however, is still true is that if I choose a lambda such that now not individual pairs of amino acids, but complete pairs of sequences in the limit of L to infinity, that I make those arbitrarily long, I can still find a lambda which in this limit still fulfills this equation. I mean, I can do it for every finite L, and if I then take infinitely long sequences, this will converge to some finite value lambda. And as it so turns out, this value of lambda again appears in the island peak score distribution. It is still a Poisson distribution, and it appears with this parameter lamda, and therefore the Gamba parameter lambda is still the same. I mean, if you believe that the island peak score distribution is Poisson, it's exponential, then you know that it must be this lambda, right? Because if I assume that these H's here by themselves are exponentially distributed, I mean, it decays exponentially. If I pick something which is too small here, I will then this thing will, for L to infinity, go to zero, because these things, high-scoring things, things with large age, become increasingly rare, and they become rare faster than I scale them up. On the other hand, if I pick a too large a lambda here, then high-scoring ages become rare, but I multiply all of these very rare things by even a higher factor, so this thing will diverge. And so if I always fix that as 1, then I have a balance between how rare these high-scoring ions become and with what sort of factor I multiply all of these high-scoring ions. Right? So, I mean, if you accept that it's an exponential distribution still, then this must be the correct value of lambda. So what is this? Well, this H, let's remember in the directed polymer, is the free energy, right? So E to the H is a partition function, and E to the lambda H is then the lambda power of the partition function, you can put a beta in here, it is some power of the partition function. So that's the expected value of the replicated partition function, which you have to equate to 1. So if you can calculate the replicated partition function with a continuous replica index up here of the system, then you just have to equate it to 1, and then you can tell the biologist, Stephen Eichel, what the value of lambda should be. Right? Unfortunately, of course, it's really hard to calculate the replicated partition function, but what I want to tell you about in the last minute is a result of mine, if you ignore these correlations, okay, we can't do anything about these correlations, but if you ignore these correlations, and if you go onto this special line, so you use this special scoring system for DNA, and you go on a special line where a gap, two gaps are the same price as one mismatch, then you can actually calculate this replicated partition function here, and then of course equate it to 1 and get a formula, closed formula for lambda, and that's even a very simple formula. How does that work? Okay, so what we want to do is we want to calculate this replicated partition function for that sort of a lattice, and what I'm doing instead is I again go on. Probably not work again. I hope you get the idea. So you make a rectangular lattice and say it has a certain width, 2w, and you iterate the same recursion equation on this lattice here. Global alignment, of course, right? We left local alignment behind us. This condition is purely a global alignment condition, which tells you what the lambda of local alignment will be. Now, we can pick out one of these elements on the lattice, and we know what the recursion equation is which calculates this edge, and this edge, if we know this one, and this one, right? We have this recursion equation, we can think of that as a dynamical process, it's a surface growth process which goes from left to right. And since all these signs are sort of difficult to remember, I probably better show it to you here. So this is this element. Here on the diagonal, we have something which I now call eta instead of small s, because it's not quite a small s, it's these uncorrelated versions of the small s. So this is either 1 or minus mu, depending on if I have a match or mismatch, but it's not match or mismatch, but just 1 with probability, say, 1/4, and 0, minus mu with a probability of 3/4. Actually, what I show here, I even equate that to zero. That is because there is a very simple symmetry to the system where you can shift things along one parameter. And basically, for global alignment, you know that if you shift all scores by a certain constant, that just changes your average growth of velocity of the sequence of the surface, the free energy per length by a constant, but it doesn't change any of the internal degrees of freedom. And I know the length, and I can always subtract the length and whatever I added on the score. Okay, if you do that, you again introduce these height differences, surface height differences, score differences along these edges as your new variables, which I call these N1, N2, and so on and so forth. And you can calculate what the dynamics of these N's is, right? You know the dynamics of the H's, so you know what the dynamics of these N's are. And you find out these sort of interesting properties of them. They all become independent of the absolute score. Well, that's not so surprising because they are differences. But if you look at the allowed values, you suddenly find out that they are either 0 or 1. That's all the dynamics allows in this case. And of course, due to the lattice structure here, you have to, if you know these two ends and the eater, you can calculate these two ends. And then, of course, in the next step, you have to know this end and this end in order to calculate these two ends. And this is, of course, described by a transformation. So you can look at every pair of N1 prime and N2 prime, and every pair of N1 and N2s, and write down what the transfer matrix for that is, with which probability you get from one state to the other. And it turns out to be the following matrix. Okay, what I'm writing here is now the final configuration, the starting configuration. If I look at a pair of neighboring N1 and N2s, then they can either both be 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, or 1, 1. And if you just calculate what this dynamics gives you, you see that the transfer matrix looks like that. So that already looks really pretty, right? And what you get here, 1 minus p, 0 p, where p is the probability that this eater is 1. So the match probability, that's of course a parameter. We have still two parameters here in principle. One of them, which I shifted out, is mu equals 2 delta, and then this probability is still an independent parameter in the problem. So what does that mean? Well, that means if there is 0, 0, it remains 0, 0. If it's 1, 1, it remains 1, 1. If it's 0, 1, it remains 0, 1. But if it's 1, 0, it can either stay 1, 0, or it can go to 0, 1. And that is very well known as the asymmetric exclusion process, where you say, okay, I have a lattice here, 2, W minus 1. This corresponds again to cut in this direction. And at every lattice side, I have either a particle or I don't have a particle, which corresponds to a 0 or a 1 of these differences. What does that say? Well, if I look at two neighboring sides which are empty like those, after one time step, they still will be empty. If I look at two sides which are occupied, like these two, they will still be occupied. If I look at a combination like this, it will still remain the same combination. But if I look at a combination like these two, then this particle has the possibility to jump over with a probability 1 minus p, or it remains where it is with a probability p. Okay. And that is exactly, what lots of people have been studying. That's the asymmetric exclusion process. What we want to know is now this replicated partition function of this asymmetric exclusion process. And well, of course, I mean, there are different versions of that. In a sense, you can say that if you would do it in continuous time and continuous space, then, I mean, Meron already a long time ago has calculated this replicated partition function in the picture of the directed polymers in a random medium. Bernard Derrida has calculated the replicated partition function of the asymmetric exclusion process in continuous time, I think in 99, that's only 2 years ago nowadays. But what we want to know here really is the replicated partition function in this discrete time, discrete space. I mean, we don't have a choice to choose a lattice, right? The biologists give us the lattice, so we have to calculate this object again. But all you have to do is basically, there's one more thing you have to know. In this dynamics, and this is the dynamics for these n's now, you have to still know what does the h do. And the h basically changes by something, I think it's 1/2, but it doesn't really matter by how much, if a particle jumps. Right? So if you want to calculate e to the lambda h expectation value, what you have to do is to put a source term in here. I think it's lambda over 2, but I mean, the important thing is you have an e to the lambda times some constant up there. And then you use these transfer matrices. That is P0. When you look at this lattice tells you, well, your dynamics first take the first pair, the even pairs, and do the transformation. Then you take the odd pairs and do the same thing. And then the even pairs, and so on and so forth. So from this small transfer matrix, you can write down a transfer matrix for all the n's on the whole web. Right? It's just the tensor product of W of those and a shift, and then another tensor product of W of those and a shift back. And what you're interested in is this long-term behavior, long-time behavior of this. Okay, this is T0 of lambda. You can calculate a global transformation T of lambda, and this is then just given basically by rho of lambda, where rho of lambda is the largest eigenvalue of T of lambda. Right? I mean, you want to know long-time behavior, which means you apply this T of lambda a lot of times, and that is given by the largest eigenvalue of that. And what a nice thing about this asymmetric exclusion process is that you can calculate this rho of lambda for small w, and if you see how it works for the first small w, you even know what the w to infinity limit for that should be. And so the final result of that is the following formula: square p lambda over 2 1 plus mu 1 plus square root p minus lambda over 2 1 plus mu. At that point I already made this to the power n. At this point I already made this transformation, which got rid of this mu. I reversed the transformation and put the mu back in. So this is now an explicit expression which contains our two parameters, mu, which is equal to delta, and p, and it contains this lambda, which is on the left-hand side. So with that, we can now, of course, do everything we want. For example, we can calculate the logarithm of this object divided by n, which turns out to be some function v of mu times lambda, and it is actually an odd function of lambda. This V of mu is, of course, just this average growth rate of the surface, where this V of mu is zero, would again give us the phase transition point of this even more restricted problem than what I showed you for the phase transition line. And most importantly, the lambda squared term here is missing, and that is basically a reflection of the fact that we have this n to the 1/3 scaling of the free energy in the KTZ problem. And it's basically Cardano's result again, just that, I mean, this is calculated on a discrete lattice, and this would be the Wapnicka index here, n to the 1/3, which has been a continuous variable here from the beginning. In terms of the sequence alignment application, to get back to that, you just equate that to 1, right? That was a condition for lambda. You can equate that to 1. You got an equation for lambda. And you can look at that numerically. This is for the DNA alphabet, again, 4 letters. We have one parameter here, mu equals to delta. I fix the parameter p to be 1/4. And then this red line is the solution of this equation equated to 1, this expression equated to 1. That's an equation which you can, I mean, in no time solve numerically. You don't have to do any simulations for that. That's the red line. You see it hits 0 down here at mu equals 2. That would be the phase transition point in the absence of correlation. And then you can do actually all the work of simulating, right? You take random sequences, you align them, you basically fit an extreme value distribution to many of the such alignments, and you extract the parameter lambda you get from that. And if you do that for uncorrelated disorder, you get these blue circles, which obviously fit this line perfectly. And if you do it for the correlated disorder, you get these green squares here, which are not too far off either. So, I mean, the scoring system as such is, of course, not so really interesting for people who do alignments, but at least this shows you, A, that you don't make too much of a mistake if you make like the correlation, and B, it is sort of a test ground where you can check other heuristics and approximations, because in here you can actually calculate what should come out, at least if you do it without the correlation. Okay, I guess that's time to stop here. Maybe just for curiosity, if somebody is more interested in asymmetric exclusion processes, if you wanted to look at more complicated things like these Lawson matrices here, this would still map to an asymmetric exclusion process, but to a more difficult one where you have more than one particle at one side. You still have a maximum number of particles, for example, 4, so you can hop like 0 or 1 or 2 or 3 particles, but you never can hop more than what would occupy that. But I'm unfortunately not aware of any calculations of replicated partition functions for that sort of more complicated process. So that, of course, would give you formulas for lambda for more complicated coins. Okay, so I guess I will just stop here at that point. And I mean, if you have any questions, I'm still around for 1.5 more weeks. And otherwise, of course, if you need questions, okay, so this afternoon, Michael will talk about probabilistic alignments at 2 p.m. And then tomorrow we will meet in the small seminar room. It's, I think, this direction over there at 10 a.m. At 10:30, sorry.
I have a small question.
Sure.
Why do you call it a sequence alignment?
Because the theory of what happens to a maximum of many random variables has been developed by Gumbel.
No, it wasn't.
It wasn't? Really?